would be turning in your Bible over to the book of 3 John, the last of these little Johns, as Brother Mitchell called them. We'll go on into the book of Jude, Lord willing, next week. But of course, 2 John, 3 John, both relatively small books, and part of the reason for that is we study the text of each is that John has some things that he's writing to them, but he doesn't really want to write with pen and paper. He wants to come to them. And so in both cases, he's planning on coming, and he has some other things to discuss with them, but he prefers to do it in person. And so he's writing some things that are of utmost importance that need to be dealt with, and maybe even some things that are better handled in writing. And then he plans to come to them and deal with these other things. The setting is much the same, again, written toward the end of the first century. You still have the Gnosticism and so forth that's going on. You have these false teachers. And as he hinted at, or didn't hint at, he said in 2 John that you need to be aware of these false teachers and giving them Godspeed in helping them in their efforts. And certainly you'd want to help the ones that are teaching the truth, and you would not want to help those that are teaching error, and that's what he goes on and deals with in a little more detail, really, in this book of 3 John. So as we're dividing the book up, the first section, would be the address and salutation, who he's writing to, what he's writing about, in the first four verses. It says, "The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and that you may be in good health as it goes well with your soul. For I rejoiced greatly when the brothers came and testified to your truth, as indeed you are walking in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth." And so first of all, there in verse 1, we have the address, John calling himself, once again, the elder. Remember, that's the same as we had in 2 John. And we said at that time that that was probably a reference more to his age and his relationship to these people as opposed to being an elder in the church, but just that he is older and wiser. Of course, he was an apostle, and the relationship that he has with these. And then it says, to the beloved Gaius. We don't know exactly who this is. Gaius is a very common name in the first century and occurs several times in the New Testament. Some of those additional times, in Acts chapter 19, verse 29, they're in the city of Ephesus, and it says, "So the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in travel." And so as Paul was there in Ephesus, he had one who was traveling with him by the name of Gaius. In Acts chapter 20, verse 4, we have a list of people being given. It talks about Gaius of Derbe. And then in the last chapter of Romans 16, verse 23, says, "Gaius, who is host to me and to the whole church, greets you." And so a Gaius there was hosting Paul. And then 1 Corinthians 1:14, I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius. And so you have that term in several places, but it's impossible to know if any of those are referring to the same person. If they're all referring to the same person, most likely not. But whether even any of them are referring to the same person, and whether John here in 3 John is addressing any of these people that were mentioned previously. So again, it's a common name, and we don't know a whole lot about the person. But we do know from what John has to say to him that he's evidently a faithful Christian. He's someone who's continuing to walk in the truth. He uses the word beloved there, which shows something, the relationship that John has with this man Gaius. And he considers him beloved and his child in the faith. And he says, "whom I love in truth." That's kind of John's stamp of approval upon his character and the type of man that he is. That he loves him, and he loves him in truth. As they both stand in truth in God's Word, then they have that relationship and that common bond there in that relationship. As we move into verse 2, he says, "Beloved, I pray that all may go well with you." Again, that's a fairly common greeting, you know, that things would go well with you, that you may prosper, as some of the other versions say. It means to be led along a good road. And so to get along well, to prosper, to succeed. And then he talks about his health, that you may be in good health. Again, that's something fairly common that we might say today. You know, hope that things are going well for you. Hope your health is good. And so those are fairly common. What's not so common is the last part of the verse, which is the standard that he appeals to for the first two. And it's interesting. As it goes well with your soul. Notice that's the standard to which the other two are compared. John knows Gaius well enough to know that things are well with his soul. He knows that he's a good Christian man and that he's doing well as far as his soul's concerned. And so that's the standard of comparison, that all may go well with you in your life in general, and that your health may be good. So he's saying in essence that if things go as well for you in general and things go as well for you physically as they're going for you spiritually, as your soul is doing, then you're going to be well off in all of those areas. And, you know, that's a good standard. It would be great if that same be said of all of us, that the standard, you know, if your health and otherwise you're doing as good as your soul, then there's nothing to worry about. Moving on into verse 3, it says, "I rejoice greatly when the brothers came and testified." Came and testified, they are both present participles, which suggest a repetitive action. These messages, these people that are coming back and forth, that John is hearing reports of Gaius and other people and how they're doing spiritually as well as physically and so forth. It's not just a one-time deal that somebody came along and said, "Oh, Gaius, he's doing great." But it's a repetitive thing. It's something that he's heard many times from probably many different people. As they've traveled from where Gaius was, where John was, and the text doesn't tell us where either one of them are, so we don't know that. But as they travel back and forth, it's consistent that people have a good report about Gaius. And again, that's a good thing to be said of us, isn't it? If people consistently have a good report for how we're doing, and especially how we're doing spiritually, as is the case here. He says that they came and testified to your truth, as indeed you are walking in the truth. And so again, we see that lifestyle that Gaius is living. And we've seen as we've gone through these letters of John's to walk in the light, to walk in love, to walk in truth. All of those being a lifestyle, an order of life that you live. To be right with God, we must walk in the truth. We must walk in the light. We must walk in love. We must walk where God walks if we're going to have fellowship with Him. And we're going to be in a right relationship with Him. And so, walking in truth. We do this walking in truth by observing God's commandments. By doing the things that God said to do, then we walk in truth. Truth is the Word. And so we walk in the Word. That's walking in truth. You know, the same or similar statement is made of Zacharias and Elizabeth in Luke chapter 1, verses 5 and 6. Of course, they're the parents of John the Immerser. And it says there as the angel comes, and they're going to, or actually it's introducing them at this point. It says, "In the days of Herod, king of Judah, there was a priest named Zacharias and of the division of Abijah. And he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord." You know, again, what a great commentary on a person's life. that would be said. They lived righteous before God, walked blamelessly in all His commandments and statutes. You know, if when we die that can truthfully be written on our tombstone, then we've succeeded. We've lived a good life, a good godly life. And then verse 4, we've actually brought this text in some in our lessons on personal evangelism. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. And as we've said, you know, there is no greater joy than when you see those that you have had a part in their conversion. And not that we cause any increase or anything, but you've been part of the teaching process or the encouraging process. And then you're able to see them not only baptized, but continue to grow and to become a strong, mature Christian. What a blessing that is. And so that's what John, as he's observing Gaius, and he's getting these good reports back, and he knows how faithful he is. Certainly he finds great joy. No greater joy, says, than that can there be. Next section then, as he moves into the kind of the meat of the text, the New Testament law and missions. Again, how are we supposed to be receiving or not receiving these various people and these various teachers? And keep in mind again that in that time, they normally, when you traveled, you stayed with people. You stayed with relatives or people that you knew through some other means. And so when the church started and you had the Christians then, you would stay with other Christians. You would stay with people that you had that like precious faith with. You may or may not know them. You know, one thing I love about traveling is going to churches where we've never been before. And it's kind of a point of contention sometimes with the kids. They're like, well, we don't know anybody there. I'm like, yeah, you do. They're all your brothers and sisters. You just hadn't met them yet. You know, that's the way I feel about it. But and that's the way, you know, these people would go and they would stay in people's homes. They were brethren. They just hadn't met yet. They didn't know each other physically, but they knew that they had that common bond with one another. And so, as these false teachers are going out, then you needed to be careful and make sure that you were helping the one that you should, but not helping one that's going to go out and cause problems in the church. So, picking back up in verse 5 through verse 8, Beloved, it is a faithful thing that you do in all of your efforts for these brethren, strangers as they are, who testified to your love before the church. You will do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God, for they have gone out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support people like these, that we may be fellow workers for the truth. So, he says it's a faithful thing you do. What is Gaius doing? He's accepting these other Christians, many of them missionaries, many of them preachers that are going about trying to fulfill the Great Commission. And he is receiving them. We know that from the text as it follows. In other words, he's doing God's work. It's a faithful thing he's doing as he's supporting them in this way. He says, again, for these brothers, strangers as they are. Again, they're brethren. They just hadn't met yet. And so they're strangers, but they're not really strangers. They're brothers. Gaius has extended fellowship to these missionaries, even though he doesn't know them personally. And, you know, I think most of us are that way. If somebody shows up and you know, we live in a society where we're a little nervous sometimes about. But if somebody shows up and we know for sure that they are a brother or sister in Christ, we'll give them the shirt off our back, won't we? We'll invite them into our home, give them a bed for the night, give them a meal, whatever it is that they need. If they're a brother, and certainly that's the way that it should be. Verse 6, who testify to your love before the church. And so these missionaries, these Christians that are traveling, as they stay there and they're given support by Gaius, they're given a place to stay and even supported on their journey, then they're testifying to the good things that he's doing. Again, that's part of the news that's coming back to John about Gaius and this good report that he's receiving. So they're testifying before the church. his example is being set before others is what they ought to be doing. You ought to be doing the same thing that Gaius is doing. And he says, you'll do well to send them on their journey. So to continue on in this practice, Gaius, of helping these people. Now, we have other ways that we would help missionaries today. We don't normally, we have motels and all, a little different society than what they had. But we certainly have other means that we need to be helping these people. But he says, send them on their journey. In the first century, in that context, it means to accompany them even on a portion of the way. Normally, when one of these people would come by, when they left, you would go so far with them and give them some companionship. You know, most of these people are going to be walking. They might, a few of them are lucky enough to have some type of animal to ride on, but most of them are going to be walking. And so you walk with them a ways. And also you supply their needs for the journey. You give them the food and so forth that they're going to need to get on to the next place that they can receive some more support. And so that was the custom at the time. Now we see that same idea in Romans 15, verse 24, where Paul says, I hope to see you in passing as I go to Spain, and to be helped on my journey there by you once I've enjoyed your company for a while. So as Paul and his future plans to go on to Spain, he's planning on going through Rome and being able to stay there and participate in their hospitality and then receive the support of them going with him maybe for a ways and supporting him on that journey. He tells Gaius, as you continue in this, you will do well. Notice there it's future tense. He's already been doing this, but the expectation is that he's going to continue to do it. Maybe these same missionaries will be coming back through. Maybe it's different missionaries, Christians, that are going to be coming through. But the expectation is that Gaius is going to continue this help and this support. Verse 7, for they have gone out for the sake of the name. Now this is talking about these Christians, these missionaries that are going out to teach. What are they doing? They've gone out for the sake of the name. They're not out doing something for themselves, but they're going out doing something for the name. Well, what name is that? Obviously, from the context, it's the name of Christ that they're doing this in. We see that in several other passages. Acts chapter 5, verses 40 and 41. It says, and when they had called the apostles, they beat them and charged them not to speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. Then they left the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name. Doesn't have to say the name of Christ, that's implied. We know whose name it is it's talking about. James chapter 2, verse 7 says, are they not the ones who blaspheme the honorable name by which you were called? Again, whose honorable name? The name of Christ. 1 Peter 4, verse 16, yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. The name of Christ. The name that we wear is Christians. And so these people have gone out for the sake of the name. They've gone out not as these Gnostics have to try to bring Jesus down in some way, but these are true preachers and missionaries that have gone out to try to teach souls about Christ. And so the word name here is used in a way that it would include all that Jesus did and taught, not just his authority. You know, sometimes we talk about in the name of, meaning the authority. But here, as it's used, it's broader than that. Everything that Jesus did, what he taught, all that's encompassed in Jesus is part of going out in his name. In the Old Testament, the name normally stood for Jehovah, God the Father, we would say. In the New Testament, the name is synonymous with Christ. And then he says, accepting nothing or taking nothing from the Gentiles. So as they're going out and they're preaching, and by this point they're preaching primarily to a Gentile audience, but they're not going out taking from them. You know, it's very common today, especially as you look at these tent meetings and so forth that denominations have, and you know, or even if they have a revival, as they would call it, that they're building, they're normally going to pass the plate every night. You know, we just pass it on Sundays. They'll pass it every night. But and it's a difference in attitude here, but what he's saying, you know, if they go out to teach people and they're asking the ones they're teaching for money, what is the accusation that can be made? Well, they're preaching for profit. They're just out preaching for money. And sometimes, unfortunately, that can be true. And so what we find the New Testament church doing, and the pattern that we try to follow, is that those that are already Christians support those then who go out to teach the lost. And we don't expect the lost to be paying for that message to come to them. And once they become a Christian, then they would participate, of course, in that sending as well. Verse 8, therefore we ought to support people like these missionaries that are going out, that we may be fellow workers for the truth. So fellow workers, support them. Remember back in 2 John, a couple of weeks ago, in verse 9, it talked about that if we welcome and support those false teachers, that we become partakers in their evil works. And so we need to be watchful of that. But on the same token here, when we receive and assist those who preach the truth, we become fellow workers in what they're doing. And of course, that's a good thing. Again, we need to be discerning and making sure that we're supporting the right one. Well, let's move into the next section, verse 9. John's apostolic authority is questioned. There's a man, again, we don't know where Gaius is, what congregation he's at, but there's a man within that congregation that's pretty bad guy. He wants the church to revolve around him. And so he doesn't even accept the authority of John as an apostle. It says, I have written something to the church, but Diotrephes, who likes to put himself first, does not acknowledge our authority. He's writing this letter to Gaius, and maybe that's to get around Diotrephes. It seems that he sent an earlier letter directly to the church, but Diotrephes has intercepted it and threw it away or whatever he did with it, and never let it come to the light of day within the congregation itself. And so he said, I've written something to the church, but Diotrephes does not acknowledge our authority. So here you have an apostle, the last apostle that's still living. He's writing this church about an urgent matter, and you have this one within that church who suppresses the letter, maybe even destroying it, and will not allow the brethren to see it. We see the reason why. He says, who likes to put himself first. He's a lover of the first place, is what that literally means. You know, it'd be great if we could say, well, there's no problem with anyone like Diotrephes today, but we know that's simply not true. A disposition that's too often found in the church is the attitude of Diotrephes, wanting that first place, wanting to look important, wanting everybody to be looking at them instead of looking to Christ. That's kind of what we see there in 1 Corinthians, whenever they're putting these various preachers on a pedestal instead of looking to Christ. But here it's a man within the congregation that wants that preeminence, wanting it to the point that he would literally suppress or destroy a letter from the Apostle John and keep it from coming to that congregation. So he refused to act according to the instructions, according to John's authority. As he rejected the letter that came from John, he rejected John. And who was John again? John was an apostle. John was one of the apostles that Jesus had delegated his authority to, that the Spirit had came and guided into all truth. And so in rejecting the apostle John, he also rejected Christ. And he also rejected God the Father as well. You know, he couldn't have that one piece and accept the rest. It just didn't work that way. They all came together. The authority that John had was the authority of God himself. Well, verse 10, the domination of Dr. Fees. Again, what's he trying to do within this congregation? Can you imagine being a person who lived in the first century and you were a scoundrel in the church and having your name recorded in the Bible for all eternity? You know, that would not be a good thing. But here's Dr. Fees. It says in verse 10, So if I come, I will bring up what he is doing, talking wicked nonsense against us. And not content with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers and also stops those who want to and puts them out of the church. Well, John says, if I come, we see later on he has full intention of coming. Of course, he doesn't know that he'll be able to do that, but he does plan on coming. And when he comes, he's going to face Dr. Fees face to face. He wants to help these brethren. He wants to get this congregation back where they ought to be. But we see a description here of Dr. Fees' lordship, his power within this congregation, as he's again striving to be in the spotlight and having it revolve around him. It says, talking wicked nonsense against us. Who's us? I would assume it's the apostles. John there is part of that group. But he's talking, means to babble, to accuse idly or falsely, wicked or evil. The things that he's saying are certainly not good, the things that have no part in the church. But then he goes on and talks about what they were doing. He refused to receive these missionaries, these people that Gaius has been accepting and he's being commended for. Dr. Fees refuses to accept them. The people that come with the truth and with the authority of John and others, he refuses them. But not only is he satisfied with that, or he isn't satisfied with that, but he stops others who want to receive them. He's probably even opposed Gaius, because Gaius is accepting him. He's part of the same congregation, evidently. But he's trying to stop that. Even to the point that he puts those out of the church who will not obey him. If they won't go along with what Dr. Fees says, doesn't matter what the Lord says, but if they won't go along with what Dr. Fees says, then he puts them out of the church. Of course, we realize that he doesn't really have the power to put anybody out of the church. He can't sever a person's relationship with Christ. But he can, I guess, stop them from coming physically to be a part of that group. And evidently that was what he was doing. Well, let's move into verses 11 and 12. We have kind of a contrast between Dr. Fees and his ways and another man that's in the congregation there by the name of Demetrius. 11 and 12 says, Beloved, do not imitate evil, but imitate good. Whoever does good is from God. Whoever does evil has not seen God. Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself. We also add our testimony, and you know that our testimony is true. And so he says, do not imitate or follow not. It means to mimic, to imitate. The literal Greek means to keep on imitating not. If you've been imitating them, then stop it. Don't be imitating. And so he's, do not imitate evil. Well, as we look at the text, we see who he's talking about specifically there is Dr. Fees. Don't do what Dr. Fees is doing. He's in direct opposition to God himself. And so certainly don't imitate him. But he says, but do imitate good. The next verse then, we're going to be introduced to Demetrius, which represents good and the good things that one. So you have an example of evil, you have an example of good. You don't follow Dr. Fees, you follow Demetrius. You know, I wonder again how Dr. Fees felt when this letter came to light in the church there. But the sources, not only does he give examples of good and evil, but he also shows the sources of good and evil. Where these come from. He says, whoever does good is from God. And so, Demetrius, he has his source in God, the source of everything that's good. Whereas on the other hand, whoever does evil has not seen God. That's the case with Dr. Fees. He may be a leader in the church there, but he doesn't know God. He's never seen God. Satan would be his father and the one that he's really following. So as we come into verse 12, we're introduced then by name to Demetrius. Demetrius has received a good testimony, and he goes on to talk about who this testimony is from. Gaius, he's already said, has received a good testimony. He's been hearing good things about Gaius. Diotrephes, certainly not. Now you have Demetrius, again, who's received a good testimony. But notice who he's received it from. First of all, he says, from everyone. You know, basically, everybody that knows Demetrius has good report. Everybody has good things to say about him. Again, that's a good thing. That's the way that Gaius is. But secondly, the second one is interesting, from the truth itself. The truth itself bears witness. His life conformed to the teaching of the Word, to truth, to law. You know, as one who breaks the law is condemned by it, the one who keeps the law is approved by it. You know, every once in a while James will come in his blue uniform. You know, why are we not scared to death when we see him in that blue uniform? Well, because we're not ones that break the law. And so we're ones who keep the law, and so the law approves us. You know, I'm sure I've told you this, but when we worked with the children's home down at Sunny Glen, the children there were absolutely scared to death. The policeman, a police car. You know, you see a police car, they're literally jumping under the seats of the van. Why? Because they came from homes where the law was broken, and so the law condemned them. And they saw authority, that blue uniform, that police car, is who came and took mom and dad away. And you can't explain to a four-year-old that mom and dad were the ones in the wrong. You know, they see mom and dad always as the ones in the right, as I guess they should. But the one who keeps the law, the one who breaks the law is condemned by it. That's the case with Dr. Fees. He's being condemned because he's in opposition to the law. Demetrius is being given a good testimony by the truth itself, by law itself, because he's one who keeps the law. And thus he's approved by it. And so, in this way, truth becomes an independent witness of the faithfulness of those who walk in harmony with it. And then he gives a third one who gives testimony, and that's John himself. He said, we also add our testimony. And so John and those who he's including in the we there give this testimony. And certainly the testimony of an apostle is a strong testimony. Well, then we come to the conclusion, the last three verses. I had much to write to you, but I would rather not write with pen and ink. I hope to see you soon, and we will talk face to face. Peace be to you. The friends greet you. Greet the friends, each by name. And so I'd rather not write with pen and ink. Again, John is wanting to come and be with them. He's wanting to share things face to face. You know, there are some things that are better to discuss in person. There are some things that are better in writing. And John knows the difference between the two. I think maybe this opposition to Dr. Fees is something that was better in writing. Something that the congregation could receive and see in writing what John had said. Whereas when he came face to face, it might just look like a big argument between the two. But he lays out very clearly what Dr. Fees is doing here. And so it was something that had an urgency to it. It needed to be dealt with. And was probably best dealt with in the letter. But he has other things on his mind that he wants to come and talk face to face. And so I hope to see you soon. And we will talk face to face. And so that's again the reason that the letter is so short. Verse 15, as he closes, peace be to you. Again, that's a normal greeting, a normal departure from a person. Peace be with you. But it is something that certainly that has meaning. It's not just something that's said off the cuff. these people should have peace, the peace of Christ, the peace of the Lord being with them. And it says the friends greet you. Others, probably that were there with John, knew Gaius. They're sending their greeting. Gaius would have known who they were. We don't, because we're not in that situation. And he says, greet the friends. And so this greeting is being given as he closes, going both ways. That the ones with John are being greeted, or sending their greeting to Gaius. But Gaius also greet the friends that are there with him. The ones that he knows are friends with John's, and maybe the others that are there with John's. And again, they knew who each other were. We're not privy to some of that information as far as exactly the locality and so forth of these. But notice he says each by name again. That's part of what Brother Bates has been bringing out on Wednesday evening, the importance of using names and the closeness that brings out. And I think that's interesting here that he brings it out here. You greet the friends each by name. You make sure that it's a personal greeting, something that's going to involve them. And so it's a heartwarming expression. We all love to be greeted by name. And so greet one another. You know, there's even something to learn in that, is that we need to greet each other. We need to always express our thanks to see one another, and certainly we do that. So that brings the book again to a close, John's writing to a close. But some very important things is we live in a society where there's, again, many false teachers that go out, not just from the denominational world, but even in the case that they had there, even from within the church. And so we have to be careful of the same thing, don't we? And use some discernment of who is it not only that we support, but that we, even by an implied endorsement of, because we participate in their works, we need to be careful of those things. Lesson's yours. Is anyone here this evening needs to respond to the Lord's invitation to be baptized for the remission of sins? If you have need the prayers of your brothers and sisters, whatever your need might be, if we can be of assistance, if you'd let it be known as we stand and sing.